Some of you probably remember, maybe all of you do, back in 2013 when the present Pope, who took the name Francis, Pope Francis, was responding to questions about whether there was a gay lobby in the Vatican. And he was doing something that many other popes before him didn't do. He'd get out there and he would just off the cuff make comments and take questions from reporters. And sometimes some people consider that rather risky. And there's a reason that other popes before him didn't do that. Because you want to be carefully prepared on the statements you made, because you can rest assured that somebody is going to take something out of context and use it and make it that you appear to be saying something you're not actually saying. But this Pope would go out there and he would take questions from the media. And then one of the statements that the Pope made on that particular occasion is now famous. It made headlines all over the world. Here's what he said. If a person is gay and seeks God and has goodwill, who am I to judge? Who am I to judge him? That expression, who am I to judge, has stuck with him and is still cited today, especially by those who think that this Pope has big plans for big changes in the Roman Catholic Church. You may recall back in those days that Barbara Walters praised the Pope. Not something she's accustomed to doing very often, but she praised this Pope, claiming that, quote, the Church is returning to its roots, meaning that the Pope is restoring its founder's teaching on not judging others. And she went on to claim, and she received some fire for this, she went on to claim that the Pope was loosening his stance on abortion and homosexuality. I don't know how she came up with that, but His supporters and the people at the Vatican insist that's absolutely not the case at all. Well, others in the media couldn't wait to point out what they saw as a stark contrast between this Pope and the previous one, Benedict XVI, who said that homosexual behavior was, in his words, quote, an intrinsic moral evil, end of quote. And the media, of course, many reporters, not all of them, you can't paint them all with the same brush, but at least a good many of them were all excited about that. They said, wow, how radically different these two popes are. One says it's uses the expression intrinsic moral evil, and the other says, who am I to judge? Was it really all that different, though? Or is it just talking about, is it kind of one of the statements out of context? In reality, when you look at that statement that erupted in such a frenzy, when you look at it standing alone without context, it's kind of ambiguous, isn't it? Now, some of you responded when I said that with a kind of a gasp that he said, who am I to judge? But yet, it's kind of ambiguous when you examine it. It says, let's look at it again. It says, if a person is gay, now the question comes to my mind, what did the Pope mean when he said that? You see, what's in the minds of many people is practicing homosexual. But is that what was in his mind? Or was he talking about a person who is same-sex attracted, but not practicing? One who is celibate? See the ambiguity we get into when we start looking at these things. So if a person is gay and seeks God, what does that mean? Seeks God. What does it mean in the mind of a Roman Catholic? What does it mean in the mind of a man who's a cradle Catholic, grows up in the Roman Catholic Church, is all he knows, he's now Pope. What does it mean to seek God? Does it have anything to do with going to confession, confessing one's sins, seeking forgiveness? Perhaps so. But you see some ambiguity here. And has goodwill. Does that mean he's just kind of a good guy? Or does it mean that his intentions are right? That's what it would normally mean within Roman Catholic circles. And he says, who am I to judge him? Well, that's, again, you see the ambiguities there. It seems to me that if you want to know what the Pope really meant, you don't go to Barbara Walters or the popular media. For these folks, at least for many of them, again, you can't paint them all with the same brush, but for many reporters, many people in the popular media, Jesus' exhortation, judge not that you be not judged, can mean only one thing. It can mean only this. You're not supposed to tell someone else that what he or she is doing is wrong. That's what a lot of people think. You don't tell somebody else that his lifestyle is wrong. You do that and you're guilty of judging. When you express disapproval of someone else's lifestyle, you're guilty of judging that person. And the founder of Christianity says, judge not that you be not judged. Have you ever heard anybody express that kind of sentiment, that kind of thought? Most of you probably have over time. You hear it. That I think is why Barbara Walters and so many reporters got all googly-eyed over this pope when he said, who am I to judge? They took his statement to mean that. Now, I'm not an apologist for the pope. He has his own apologists who take care of all those things. But if you look at, and I'm not going to go back and reiterate, this is not my point today, but if you do go back and look at that interview, if you can call it an interview, kind of an off-the-cuff, informal meeting with some reporters, and see what else he said in that same informal session, you will see that he very clearly reaffirmed the Roman Catholic Church's official position on homosexual behavior. And what is that? It's a sin. He reaffirmed it in the same meeting. Some of the reporters didn't tell you that part. Some did. Some did, to be fair. He also reaffirmed the Roman Catholic's official position on the ordination of women to the priesthood. And what is that? Not going to happen. That's the official position. Not going to happen. It hasn't happened. And, you know, in this pope's mind, just as in his predecessor and the one before him, John Paul II, they all think that's something that's set in stone and they can't change it. They can't change it. It's already established. And once it's already established, once it's dogmatized, it's there forever. So that's the way this pope thinks, no doubt. But a lot of people, nevertheless, see him as a guy who's going to bring in all these sweeping changes. You have that both inside and outside the Roman Catholic Church. But I don't want to focus on that. I want to focus on what Jesus said about judging. And what exactly does that mean? You may remember, or maybe you don't, but several years ago, it was posted on our website. Jeff posted an article on there on the subject of homosexuality. It generated some interesting responses. And the subject of judgment came up. Judge not that you be not judged. And someone made this comment after that subject came up. He says, it's not judging when you tell people what the Bible plainly says. We're supposed to teach and preach the whole Word of God. Would you agree with that? I think everybody in here would agree with that. That's not the same thing as you're not violating what Jesus said. Judge not that you be not judged. And yet there was a response that went like this. It is judging, period, and nothing more. Leave it to God, please. So if you teach the whole Word of God, if that happens to be, you know, if there's actually commandments in there forbidding that kind of behavior, then I suppose you're judging if you preach those commandments. Another person said, homosexuality is sin, and like other sins, it is forgivable under the grace of God. However, also like other sins, it is to be abandoned once forgiven. You cannot openly and without conscience, continually practice sin and claim to be a Christian. The wanton practice of sin is not compatible with the true practice of Christianity, and real Christians do not approve of sin, including homosexuality, because they cannot in good conscience do so. I think everybody would agree with that statement, wouldn't you? It's a pretty good statement there. But the response was from the same person, says, that's your judgment call, but I don't agree with you. As a Christian, you have no right to judge lest you be judged. So you see once again that I just put it this way. I believe there is a fundamental and widespread misunderstanding of what Jesus meant when he said, judge not that you be not judged. So I'd like to look at that today. It's found in Matthew chapter 7. It's a part of the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew chapter 7 and beginning in verse 1. You find it in verse 1. Judge not that you be not judged. Now, let me ask the question first of all, is he condemning all forms of judging others? Or does he have a particular type of judging in view here? Is he condemning, you know, just taking it as it stands there, judge not that you be not judged. You could say, well, any kind of judging. Well, the problem with that is you find elsewhere he encourages judging of a particular kind. If you look, for example, over in John chapter 7, and we're not going to spend time in the context here. I'm just going to rip this one right out of context. But no, I don't want to spend a lot of time there. But I do want to show you that he does advocate judging of a certain sort. I will mention in context, he's talking about the fact that he had been accused of breaking the Sabbath. And of course, he hadn't broken the Sabbath, but someone had made that judgment. He says in verse 24, "Do not judge according to appearances, but judge with righteous judgment." You are to judge, but you are to judge rightly. There is a right way to judge. You do not judge according to appearances. You know, you could think of any number of examples of how someone might judge according to appearances, and it would be a wrong kind of judgment. For example, some fellow, we'll call him Larry. Not our Larry over here, but his name is Larry. I just think of that simply since we watched him for a while here this morning as he did his thing. But his name is Larry, and he has a friend. Let's say his friend's name is Bob. Not our Bob here, but as I'm looking around and seeing these people, I think they think of their names. But Bob one day sees Larry, again, not this Bob and not that Larry, but Bob is driving along, and he looks over and sees Larry coming out of a bar one afternoon. A bar? What's he doing in a bar? Well, what do you do in a bar? But not only is Larry coming out of the bar, there is a strange woman who is clearly not Larry's wife that's with him, and they're laughing and giggling and having a great time. And Bob thinks, uh-oh, what have I discovered here? And then he watches from a distance as Larry and this strange woman walk away and go and get in Larry's car, and they drive away together. Now, what is Bob to think? He has to make a judgment, and it's based on appearances. What would you think if you saw what Bob saw? Not this Bob. Well, you understand how someone would see something like that and would think something was going on. But as it turns out, Bob would later discover that Larry's sister was in town. She'd been out of the country for the past 10 years, and she had called from the airport and said, "Hey, pick me up at Uncle Bob's establishment." Uncle Bob, the owner, not Uncle Bob, Uncle Bill, we'll use another name. Uncle Bill's establishment. We had one of those in here too, at least one of them. Anyway, Uncle Bill, he took another one there too. Uncle Bill's establishment. See, Uncle Bill owns the bar. Said, "I haven't seen him in so many years, just pick me up there. I'd like to go by and visit with him for a little while." And so sure enough, Larry comes by and picks up his sister later on that day at Uncle Bill's bar. And this is what Bob has seen. It's totally innocent. And you see, Larry's wife is at home preparing a nice meal to greet his sister, whom they have not seen for many years. So you see how one can judge by appearances, and that's not really a righteous judgment, is it? That's the kind of judgment you have to be careful about, because you can see people doing things and you can read something into it when actually there's nothing really to be read into it. That's just an example, one of many that we could go through in talking about judgment and what constitutes right kind and wrong kind of judgment. Well, so one thing we can say for sure then is that Jesus is not saying that all forms of judging is wrong. Otherwise, he wouldn't say judge with righteous judgment. Judge rightly, in other words. Judge based on the facts, based on reality, based on truth. Also, I'll mention this. We may come back to it if we have time. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, where you see the Apostle Paul actually advocating judging. In fact, you see him judging a man and telling the church to judge a man. And you also see him condemning, or at least correcting, attempting to correct the church for going before the worldly judges rather than judging certain matters taking place inside the church among themselves. They should be judging. That's what Paul is saying. You ought to be judging and judging rightly in such matters. So again, the point here is that Jesus is obviously not condemning all forms of judgment. So then, is he saying that we should not judge the intent of a person's heart, since only God can see what's in a person's heart? Well, that kind of makes sense to think in those terms. However, I think you have a problem with that when you look at what he says in verse 15. Listen to this very carefully. He says, "Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravenous wolves." Did that say outwardly? Do they come dressed as wolves? No. Do they come huffing and puffing and attempting to blow the house down? No, they come dressed as sheep. It says, inwardly they're ravenous wolves. What does that mean? That means it's hidden. It's hidden. It's in their hearts. And here Jesus is about to tell them how they can tell the intent of the heart. In other words, he's advocating, as you're going to see here, he advocates judging. He says, "You will know them," meaning you will know who they are, what's the content of their heart. "You will know them by their fruits." Just keep watch. Watch how they behave. Watch what they say. Listen to them, watch them, and the fruits, the things they produce, will expose them for what they truly are. "Do men gather grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Even so, every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a bad tree bear good fruit." Well, that's a tongue twister there. Read it fast enough. "Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Therefore, by their fruits you will know them." In other words, by their external actions, the words they speak, the things they do, you will recognize what is internal. They're really wolves. Wolves in sheep's clothing. So here, this is a form of judgment. And so we cannot say that Jesus... He's talking about judging the intent of a person's heart, because that's exactly what he's advocating there. You can recognize evil intentions by looking at the fruits, in other words. Of course, you have to be cautious with that. Of course, you can read a thing like that wrongly and attribute motives where none exist or where different ones exist. But nevertheless, you see that he is saying that the intent of a person's heart can be discerned in many cases. So if he is not saying all judging is wrong, and if he is not even saying that one should never judge the intent of a person's heart, what is he saying? What kind of judging does he have in mind? Well, first of all, there's a broader context here. Let's look back to Matthew chapter 5, and in verse 20, Jesus says, and this is after the famous statement about, "Think not that I've come to destroy the law or the prophets. I've come not to destroy, but to fulfill." And he leads up to this statement in verse 20. He says, "For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven." The scribes and the Pharisees. Now, if you read, we've done this in the past, won't do it here, but in the past, we've gone through the Sermon on the Mount and have shown that in many of the points that Jesus raises, he is actually taking issue with what the religious leaders of his time were teaching. For instance, the eye for an eye, tooth for tooth law. The reason he takes exception to that, he's not taking exception to the law of Moses. That's a very good law. It just simply means the penalty ought to be equivalent to, the crime. You don't hang somebody for spitting on the sidewalk, in other words. It ought to be the equivalent to, or, you know, something that fits the crime. But some people are using that for vengeance, personal vengeance. And that's not what that law was designed for. Love your neighbor, hate your enemy. Well, who said that? Not Moses. Well, that's some of the religious leaders' ideas. So Jesus, throughout the Sermon on the Mount, you see what he's doing. He's actually stripping away the erroneous interpretations of the scribes and Pharisees and other religious leaders of his time and bringing out the true and full meaning of the law. So he's upholding the law, not casting it away. He's upholding it, magnifying it, and not radically redefining it, but actually bringing out the truth that it conveyed all along. And so when we get to chapter 7 and he says, judge not that you should not be judged, who do you think he has in mind here? Who's in the backdrop? Well, no doubt the religious leaders of his time were in the backdrop. He's talking about, or he's thinking of them because they're the ones who would practice this kind of judgment. In other words, they would pinpoint the relatively minor flaws of other people, and then kind of overlook or ignore or justify their own much more serious flaws. So no doubt Jesus has this group of people in mind here when he says, judge not that you be not judged. So you begin to see, I think, the kind of judgment he has in mind. Well, let's go ahead and read verses 2 through 5 to see, also to add to the context here, to show what's in his view. Verse 2 says, For with what judgment you judge, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured back to you. And then he goes on to say, and remember, same context, same subject, and why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not consider the plank in your own? Now, he's using a little hyperbole here, but it's a very valid observation. Why do you see that speck in your brother's eye, as the religious leaders were apt to do, but do not see the plank in your own? You kind of ignore it. Essentially what he's doing is say, don't be like them, because their kind of judgment is hypocritical judgment. That's why he calls them hypocrites over and over and over again. One of the reasons he calls them hypocrites. Or how can you say to your brother, let me remove the speck from your eye, and look, a plank is in your own. You kind of picture that in your mind, and it's kind of, well, you know, you can't really picture it. You know, something so obvious as a plank in your eye, and yet you're trying to get the speck out of your brother's eye. He says, hypocrite. Familiar term there, isn't it? First remove the plank from your own eye, and then, does he say, then go ahead and ignore the speck in your brother's eye? No, doesn't say that, does he? Says, then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. So he is clearly not saying that you should ignore the speck in your brother's eye. He is saying that you should first deal with the plank that is in your own eye, and then you're better equipped to help your brother with his problem. So it's not the kind of judgment Jesus has in view here is hypocritical judgment. He is not saying that there should not be judgment of others at all. Rather, he is calling for the proper ordering of judgment. Examine, therefore judge yourself first, before examining, therefore judging others. If you do that, if you deal honestly with your own shortcomings, then you are better equipped to deal mercifully and out of a spirit of love with your brother's shortcomings. And you don't do it in a hypocritical way. You don't do it in a self-righteous way. And you've probably noticed that, haven't you? When you deal with something yourself in your own life, whether it's a fault or a flaw or just a trial of some sort, and then later on when you're helping a brother who's going through something similar, you have more compassion for him, don't you? Because of what you went through. And here it's the same principle is in place here. If you deal first with yourself, deal first with your own shortcomings, then you're better equipped to help your brother, not deal with him, not self-righteously deal with him, but to actually and truly help him in overcoming his problem. So by dealing honestly with your own shortcomings first, you can rid yourself of any sense of moral superiority when you are dealing with the speck in your brother's eye. So again, Jesus is not calling for abandoning all judgment. He is really, this is another way of saying, judge righteously. It's another way of saying also, love your neighbor as yourself. Really, that's the heart of it. I think the Amplified Bible essentially captures the meaning of Matthew chapter 7 and verse 1. Now, there may be an expanded meaning. We could go on and probably expand it. But I think this is the essence of it here. It's in the Amplified Bible. And this is the way it puts it. For just as you hypocritically judge others when you are sinful and unrepentant, so will you be judged. And in accordance with your standard of measure used to pass out judgment, judgment will be measured to you. Now, the parable, some of you, or all of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the parable of the unforgiving servant. I'd like to go over there and close with that. The parable of the unforgiving servant is found in Matthew chapter 18. Now, this parable deals with a different subject, but it's a related subject. It's a different subject, but it also provides a good illustration of how the measure a person uses in judging another will be measured back to him. So even though this is a different subject, it relates to the subject at hand and shows how by judging others wrongly, with this wrong spirit, then it's going to be, we need to be aware of that because it will be measured back to us. Look at the parable, chapter 18, verse 21. Then Peter came to him and said, Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Up to seven times? That seems like an awful lot, doesn't it? You know, three times seems like a good bit. Four times, that's over the top, it seems. But seven times, he says? And Jesus said to him, I do not say up to seven times, but 70 times seven. Well, that is out there, isn't it? And it doesn't mean on the, after that many times, 490, the 491st time that you can go ahead then and lay it on him. No. It's obviously, his obvious meaning here is that you maintain that spirit of forgiveness and a desire for reconciliation. I mean, this is what it means. This is at least part of what it means to be a follower of Jesus Christ. Therefore, the kingdom of heaven is like a certain king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. And when he had begun to settle accounts, one was brought to him who owed him 10,000 talents. Now that's a huge amount. That's a huge debt. But as he was not able to pay, his master commanded that he be sold with his wife and children and all that he had, and that payment be made. The servant therefore fell down before him, saying, Master, have patience with me, and I will pay you all. Then the master of that servant was moved with compassion, released him, and forgave him the debt. Now this is a very important point here. That's a massive debt in the ancient world. 10,000 talents. That's a lot. And he was forgiven this. He got more than what he asked for. He was forgiven. He was pardoned. But the servant went out and found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 denarii. That's just a tiny little fraction of that amount that he owed, the 10,000 talents. In fact, it's only a fraction of one talent. It's just a small, very small amount. But he found this fellow who owed him 100 denarii, and he laid hands on him and took him by the throat, saying, pay me what you owe. Now, he's rendering a judgment here. He's about to render a judgment. You know, again, keeping in mind the subject, judge not that you be not judged. He's about to make a judgment, one that will affect the life of this person. So his fellow servant fell down at his feet and begged him, saying, have patience with me, and I will pay you all. And he would not, and went and threw him into prison till he should pay the debt. So when his fellow servant saw... See, that was the judgment he made, a rendered judgment right there. Had him thrown in jail and until the debt was paid. So when his fellow servants saw what had been done, they were very grieved and came and told their master all that had been done. Then his master, after he had called him, said to him, you wicked servant, I forgave you all that debt because you begged me. You see, what could have been in a guy's heart to not be willing to extend that kind of forgiveness after having been shown such mercy, not to extend just a little mercy to somebody else? Should you not also have been compassionate on your fellow servant just as I had pity on you? And here's the point. Here is how that which is measured out in judgment will come back to you. And his master was angry and delivered him to the torturers until he should pay all that was due to him. So my heavenly Father also will do to you if each of you from his heart does not forgive his brother his trespasses. So this is a different subject, but it does illustrate how the measure a person uses in judging another will be measured back to him. So it's not that Jesus is condemning all judgment. He's not. In fact, we're commanded to judge. We're expected to judge. And in reality, when you think about it, you can't get through life without making many judgments along the way. What Jesus is saying is do not practice hypocritical judgment. Do not practice judgment from the perspective of moral superiority. That's what he's saying. But practice judgment in righteousness. Be merciful. Be kind. Be loving. And in summary, love your neighbor as yourself. When it comes down to it, that's really what it's all about. That's the best policy when it comes to dealing with one's neighbor. And if you master that, then you'll master the art of judging.